Welcome to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. The views expressed here are the personal views of Dr. Witt and Dr. Farley and do not necessarily reflect those of the Department of Defense, the U.S. Army, the Army War College, or any other department or agency of the U.S. government.
Hello, Lawyers, Guns, and Money listeners. We're here with another podcast. This one's been recorded in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, on the grounds of the United States Army War College. My name is Rob Farley, and with me today, I have Jackie Witt. Say hi.
Hello, everyone.
Jackie also records most of the War Room podcasts, which are part of the Army War College's, essentially the public persona of the Army War College. And so in that sense, she is a podcast veteran. She's much more of a podcast veteran than myself. So the purpose of the conversation we're having today, we know that a lot of people in the Lawyers, Guns, and Money audience are academics or sort of academic-friendly and academic adjunct. I've been here for a year, and it's been a lot of fun being here, but there are a lot of differences between teaching in the PME or professional military education system and teaching in sort of the more traditional civilian academic institutions. And so I basically wanted to get from you what it's like being faculty in the PME system and having a career in the PME system. So maybe if you could start by telling us a little bit about sort of what your academic background is and where you went and sort of how you found your way here.
Sure. So by training, I'm a military historian of the 20th century United States. I got my PhD from UNC Chapel Hill, where I studied with Dick Cohn. I wrote my dissertation and then my first book about military chaplains, so maybe not the most strategically central characters in the story of warfare, but combining sort of religious history, cultural history, American history, military history. And I got my PhD in 2008. And if you recall what was happening in 2008, the bottom was falling out of the economy. Academic job markets have been tough places for a long time, especially for historians, and especially for American historians and for military historians. And so I was looking for employment, and I landed a 10-month contingent job at the United States Military Academy in 2008 as the bottom was falling out of the economy. The Army was clearly fully engaged in Iraq and Afghanistan, or mostly Iraq at that point, and they needed lieutenants. So they had admitted more cadets to the academies, and when more cadets came, you needed more professors. So I actually ended up staying at West Point for 4 years, and then I made a move to professional military education at the Air University, at the Air War College in Montgomery, Alabama, and then made a move up to Pennsylvania, mostly for personal reasons, but have stayed within that realm. So my entire professional post-PhD career has been working for Uncle Sam in one form or another, teaching cadets to colonels. And it's been a tremendously rewarding experience, but it's also pretty weird when I compare it to the careers that my civilian colleagues have.
You know, I mean, it's just sort of an aside. I weirdly do not remember the Great Recession at all. So, we got pregnant right around the time that my ex-wife at the time. Well, no, I guess she's still my ex-wife. But anyway, we got pregnant right around when the crash started, and then that sort of dominated. And then, of course, after the kids were born, I have no memory of anything for like 2 years. And so the Great Recession is just so entirely nominal to me. I mean, it barely exists, right? It's just something I read about in books rather than lived through. So then your first experience with PME was with cadets at West Point. And so you had taught undergrads at UNC, and then you taught essentially undergrads cadets at West Point. So what was the first big differences that you noticed between, I mean, and everybody has ROTC, or many people have ROTC students, but what was sort of the big difference about being somewhere there and what the students were like?
The biggest differences maybe are obvious ones, which is that everybody's in uniform at the beginning of classes, which start at 7:30 in the morning. So that's big. And the cadets stand up and salute their instructors at the beginning of class. So if you're not expecting that, and I had heard about this, but the first time that happens, that's weird. And the fact that everybody says hello to you in the hallway. So the military culture of greeting people that you pass, right, a salute or a good morning or whatever it is, there's a whole lot of talking that maybe doesn't happen in the hallways where every person you pass you have to say hello to. But otherwise, I've found, and this is true with colonels too, that teaching is teaching. And to me, the responsibility of professors, of educators, is to convince whoever is in front of you, whether they're in a required American history survey for their general education, for their bachelor's degree, or whether they're cadets who are also required to be in class, or whether they're colonels who have to be there. Your job is to convince them that what they're doing and what you're doing in the classroom is important, that it matters, that there's something at stake, that there's some intellectual question or some personal development that will come out of the history course you're teaching or the strategy course, and that there's a reason that you're making them read Thomas Paine or Thucydides or whomever it is. And so teaching is teaching, and the subject matter changes, the audience may change, but the work of educators is to take the life of the mind of reading and of writing and communicating, and to communicate that to students.
So after West Point, so was it right after that you got the job at the Air University?
Yes.
Right. And so that must have been, I imagine that was a leap. So I came here for 1 year, but sort of fortuitously, I arrived at exactly the moment in my life when almost everyone here is at, to like being a mid-40s, actually. I mean, really being a mid-40s white guy. The only thing that sets me apart is I have a beard. Like, I mean, that's literally, but... For you, that must have been a little bit different, though, right? Being at the Air War College after having taught cadets. So how was that transition to sort of a much older, more sort of professionally accomplished group of students?
The biggest difference is probably that colonels come with, at this point in their career, you know, 18, 20, sometimes even more years of professional experience, where cadets are traditional aged undergrads, and you might have a handful of people who had been prior service, enlisted or served in combat. The colonels, the lieutenant colonels and the civilian students all have just this wealth of experience. And so they will never look at you with the sullen dead eyes of a 20-year-old at 7:30 in the morning. They'll always have something to say. Now, whether that something to say is particularly relevant to what you're talking about or at the strategic level or at the right sort of focus point is maybe up for debate. But I find them to be really lively and engaged students. They're dedicated. They've got different life stuff going on, right? Aging parents and teenagers getting in trouble and whatever it is. And that's different from a traditional undergrad. But I think they're great fun to teach. For me, I arrived at West Point to teach when I was almost 27. I 26 years old within a week of my birthday. And I got to the Air War College when I was 31. And so I was a bit younger than the students, and I still am a bit younger. Now you can do the math. But so my age is like converging. I'm looking forward to like 5 years from now when our cultural references match, because I'm still a few years out from that. But I think one of the things I appreciate about the military, and this was true for cadets and for the colonels, is that they're trained to respect expertise and competence. And I think for the most part, they're trained to recognize it. So you have to know what you're talking about. You have to admit when you don't know what you're talking about. And I'm really upfront about the things I don't know. I've never commanded a battalion. I've never flown an airplane or driven a tank, and I probably will do none of those things. But that's not why I'm here. That wasn't what I was hired to do. I was hired to be a historian, to be a scholar, to be a teacher in the sort of national security realm. And I think I'm okay at that. And I think that they have things to learn, and I have certainly things to learn from them. So to me, it's really about when we come to the seminar room, when we come to the classroom, it's about bringing different levels of expertise and experience and knowledge and worldviews, and trying to have difficult conversations and sort those out. That's my computer beeping. You can't see me, but if you Googled me, you'll see that I have a streak of purple in my hair. I don't look maybe like people expect. And I think that that sort of, it's a really minor disruption. I'm really careful to like try to keep my hair off of my ears. Like I try to keep my hair neat, even if it's purple. But the idea that someone who's very different from you has something to contribute to the conversation is a message that I think our military students need, and they need that reinforced. And at the same time, I try to be really competent at what I do. And for the most part, that works. There might be some skepticism on day one, but I hope that by the end of 10 months, I've convinced them to come along on the intellectual journey with me, and I've convinced them that maybe people who don't look or sound like they expect at first glance, to give them a chance and to open up their minds to what they have to say.
So you're being exceedingly modest, right? I mean, you are so central to the functioning of this department and of this university that it's almost sort of unimaginable, right? I mean, I just remember that when you were talking about writing on one of those first days and you were talking about thesis statements, and you went from thesis statement, here's a decent thesis statement, here's a great thesis statement, to this auditorium full of people, and it was just like, wow, that's like, and it dawns, like, that's a great way to think about thesis statements, right? So... So where was I going next? What would you say, and I realize that I mean you haven't. So you were a graduate student, right? And so you haven't in the civilian context, and so you haven't really been sort of in the working of the way that a traditional academic department works in the civilian life, which is this, you know, exceedingly futile. Everyone is when they're in their own silo. Everybody's do not pay any attention to what I teach or what I'm doing, please. Right? I don't want the department chair to know what I'm doing. You know, that sort of thing. But it's much different here, right? Everything is collaborative, right? So, I mean, could you talk maybe a little bit about how different it is to be in that where the syllabi for the main courses are developed in association with a ton of other people, and the materials have to be developed in association with a ton of other people so that you can have these 24 seminars all working together?
Yeah, so in one respect, it's helpful that I never worked in a civilian department because I just don't know any better. So all of the syllabi, most of the syllabi I've taught on have been these collaboratively developed Frankenstein's monsters of things. I've developed my own elective courses, and that's always a great pleasure and great fun to do. But what strikes me is that given the breadth of what we have to teach, and we're not in a traditional academic department, so I'm a historian, but I work side by side with military officers, with political scientists, with area studies specialists. And so the breadth of what we have to do, if I were set out on my own to develop a syllabus to cover everything, it would be terrible. Because I just don't know things. Things are so far outside of my field and my discipline that I really rely on the expertise of others. And so, the luxury of being able to not have to write, you know, 16 or 20 coherent lessons and lectures and plans, my responsibility as a lesson author, as a contributor to this massive syllabus project, is to write two or four really, really, really good lessons on things that I do know really well, on literature that I'm really familiar with and that I can keep up with. And so if you twist it around that it's not someone watching over you and everything is mandated from above, but really you have the opportunity to specialize and to rely on the specialization of others, it's a pretty incredible process. So none of the courses are probably the way we would design them from if I were designing something from the ground up. I would change things around. And at the same time, I think they're mostly pretty good. The other thing is that our colleagues who are also teaching the same thing and who are in this broad, sort of broadly construed field of national security, I have commonalities with people all up and down the hallway and all up and down the building. So I can go next door or up to somebody on my teaching team. I can go to their office and say, hey, you know, what do you think about this? How do you teach this problem? And I've got expertise right next door. And if you're in a traditional department where maybe you're the only one who does something, that doesn't often happen. And so the collaborative environment I find to be really inspiring and sort of energizing in a way. There's always like difficulties that come with that. We're in our offices a lot. And so FaceTime matters. And when you're reading, it can be disruptive to have people sort of in and out. The work of academics often doesn't look like what the military thinks of as work. It involves a lot of thinking and being quiet and being alone. And those are not highly valued external sort of signals to the military sometimes. So I think that can be a challenge if we want to talk about a civil military gap. That's one of them. There's a colleague of ours who says that the colonels who we work for are like cocker spaniels and that academics are like cats. And that is true for the most part. The colonels are really enthusiastic, hardworking. They're really lovely people. But they're like hyperactive in wanting to do stuff. And the academic cats are like, please leave me alone. Let me find a sunny spot on the floor and then let me knock some stuff off of a desk just to be a jerk.
Well, and then to add to that, right? I mean, people come into your office and then we'll just sort of sit down, right? And I mean this your office, right? They will come in here and just sort of hang out in your office just like cats. Yeah, I mean, the process of the development of some of the courses that we do here, like national security policy and strategy and theories of war and strategy and so forth, I mean, I never have the discipline in my own courses to say this thing in means another thing out in terms of a reading, right? I just can't do it. It's like, oh, you know, I'm sure they'll be able to handle one more reading. And then like 5 years down the road, well, maybe I should actually draw back this stuff, yeah. But here, there is that discipline, right? Tammy Biddle or someone else is saying, well, that would be great to add, but what are we going to take away, right? Well, if we want to have this much more Thucydides, we have to take away this much more of that. And so that collaborative process of course construction is a much different intellectual experience than sort of what standard academics do on a regular. I mean, it's kind of like in the same way that the seminar structure here at the War College is kind of like a middle school homeroom, the way that people teach is a little bit like a big survey course with like 8 TAs at the college level for the teachers, right? In that there's not a single professor, there's like somebody who builds the courses, but everybody is sort of following these, you know, this thing that has been set forth, but there's still some freedom. I guess on this point, right, it feels like to me that this system would be really off-putting to a lot of academics, right? I mean, is that something that you can sort of tell, like, you know, sort of here are the skills you need to be successful in PME. Here are the traits that are going to make you unsuccessful in PME. And can you like talk to people and sort of get a sense of whether they would work in this kind of system?
I think yes, you can tell. So a lot of times when we talk about fit, it's code for do you look like me or think like me? And I think in PME, the question of fit is a little bit different. I think there is... It's been slow, but there's more receptivity to people who look and think sort of differently about problems, who have different training or different backgrounds. But the question of fit really is one: can you be in your office a lot? Can you meet deadlines? Can you work as part of these collaborative teams? Are you willing to? We don't have an extraordinarily high teaching load or a lot of grading to do. We're paid pretty well. Like there's lots of benefits to it, but you're going to trade off some things in terms of autonomy, in terms of the course content that you teach. Now, how you teach it once you've got the readings and the materials is really up to you. But you've got to be willing to be part of this collective effort. And the military will take as much as you are willing to give. And so drawing boundaries and like figuring out how to do your own work and your own time for writing and research is really important. And how do you maintain those ties to your own community? And the teaching, I think the people I've seen who've maybe struggled with that are people who really want to be the true expert all the time, because we teach in an interdisciplinary environment. I don't teach history classes every day. I teach history and some other stuff and national security and current events and international relations, which I had to like reteach myself after, you know, being an undergrad. So you have to be willing to be really flexible in what you teach. You can't say, well, no, I'm just not going to teach IR theory because I don't like it. Well, that's part of what we do. And so that team mentality is really truly important. And then to understand what everybody brings to the table, what your military colleagues bring to the table, what your retired military colleagues who are now serving in civilian positions bring to the table, what your students bring to the table, and just having a healthy respect and a healthy skepticism and sense of humor about all of it. Because like the computers will be stupid. There will be extra security measures. Everything you write has to go through some sort of review process. So you just have to acknowledge the absurdities and like roll with it.
I mean, that last is really interesting. It was going to be the next question I asked, which was, you know, how have you dealt with like the bureaucracy? Now, I mean, from my point of view, the bureaucracy here is sometimes maddening, but for whatever reason, like I am more tolerant of it and willing to put up with it than I am with the bureaucracy of a major flagship institution in the state of Kentucky, whose name I will not mention, that just I find absolutely maddening at like every moment. But I could see why, no, the computers really do stop working every morning if like the Chinese are trying to hack them, and it stays that way for like 8 hours. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, so I sometimes say that we here at a PME, we pile on academic bureaucracy. So we have a department chairs and a dean and a provost, and there are curriculum review committees and all of that stuff. And we have military bureaucracy. So we have the IT and the anti-terrorism training and the training after training after
always
training.
Boil your squirrel.
Always boil the squirrels and the berries. And I never remember like which are we supposed to get, high floor hotel rooms or low. Anyway, so there's all sorts of that stuff. But you take it as it comes, and you've learned to function in bureaucratically driven environments. And it's certainly no. Again, talking to my colleagues who work out in the civilian world, especially for people who work for state universities, like it's not that much stupider. It's just maybe a different flavor of silliness. And so I really hate the phrase, it is what it is, but that's the truth. And for me, it comes, the return is that I have incredible opportunities to talk to interesting people, to listen to high-ranking military and government officials on a regular basis. I have money to travel. I spend an incredible amount of money every year going to conferences and doing professional development that in resource-constrained university environments, and for historians who like are never bringing in a lot of money, would be really hard to come by. And so for me, it's all about thinking about what are the costs and benefits of the work that I do. And for me, the working in PME is a way, it's a form of public service for me. I'm not in the military. I would be terrible at it for lots of reasons. The fact that I can't tell my left from my right would be one of them. But I do think that national service is important. I do think national security matters. I think that our military officers and the citizens of the country deserve well-educated, thoughtful military leaders. And if I can help in a very small way to do that, to complicate their thinking or to give them new ways or new ideas or new perspectives, then that's worth the sort of minor inconveniences or the major inconveniences of like the computer system going down for days or weeks on end.
So I guess kind of the last thing, right? And I think that what a lot of people would really struggle with, and I haven't really, it's been sort of a little bit weird for me, but you know, the politics of these I mean, the weird thing is that we rarely talk about politics with students here at all, right? But, you know, it's very hard to miss that, except for a very, very few civilian institutions that are very niche, like Liberty and so forth. I mean, the students here and the entire environment is vastly more conservative than you would find in the civilian academy. I mean, is that ever a challenge? Is that ever... academic freedom is important here, and it's taken very seriously, right? And non-attribution and so forth. And those things are taken very seriously. But do you ever struggle, like, with that aspect of it? And I'm not even going to make any assumptions about your politics or the audience politics or whatever.
I mean, the assumptions are interesting. So I know a lot of colleagues, and I have colleagues in civilian institutions who say the same thing, that they keep their politics out of their classroom, that if they cannot let students know what they think about a certain issue, that's great. And I always think to myself, that's a luxury that only some people have. I'm a 30-something white woman with a PhD with purple hair. If I were anything other than sort of what you might expect, that would be truly anomalous in the world. And so I try not to sort of pretend that I'm something I'm...
We should pause. You're not the only purple-haired...
That's true. That's true. We're growing in number. And so I think that the way my position in the classroom here is different from the retired colonels who work here is different from even your position, right, as a middle-aged white dude academic. And so that, I think that's something that all of us have to deal with individually. I think I am constantly surprised by the diversity of views that I find among students and faculty when you have the opportunity to dig in. And it's usually in informal conversations, sort of sidebars and hallway conversations and after the fact. And it is a more conservative environment, but it's not uniformly conservative, and it's not even within the conservative sort of realm, it's not uniform between domestic politics, foreign policy. There's all sorts of positions. In Carlisle, we're close to Dickinson College, and so it has a little bit of a small town college, like college town feel. So if you're like hankering for that sort of liberal academic view, there are other outlets and there are other places. To me, the biggest challenge is that it right now, and I think this has been true since 2016, since the presidential election, this is a weird time to teach national security. And this is a weird time to teach national security process in particular, and those courses are often so based on institutions and norms and in the idea of sort of enduring processes, and that's really hard to teach right now because it does feel like there's very... It just feels like we're making it up as we go along.
Right, but the students are cognizant of that, right? I mean, I got the sense, like, the students are aware we're in a really weird situation with respect to, like, how all of this is supposed to work, right? They sort of know that this is really weird right now.
I think so, and they get the sense that this is how things are maybe supposed to work and how things have worked in the past. And now two years in, it's becoming a little bit easier to say maybe how are things working right now, and how are things different from the norms and traditions, and do we think this is anomalous? Do we think it's a blip? Do we think this represents a sort of larger swing or a shift? But it, like I said, that to me has been a real challenge. Like, how do you talk about institutions and norms when you open up the news every day or you open up Twitter? And they seem to be, the norms and institutions don't seem to be holding, and they're certainly not what's creating policy. And then the undercurrent of questions about the state of civil military relations in the United States right now is really interesting. As I said, I studied with Dick Cohn at UNC Chapel Hill, and so civil military questions are underpin almost everything I think about just by nature of how I was trained as a military historian. And so those are the things, those are the questions that I keep asking. And those are the things, those are the conversations that I wish were maybe forefronted, a little bit more closely in our courses. Right now, I think the assumption has been that everybody understands what civilian control of the military is and looks like. And so it's really rarely explicit in our curriculum, even though it has to underpin all of what we teach. And I think maybe it's time to do a little bit more explicit talking about that.
Right. Well, I think that's especially true because, a third, but between a fifth and a quarter of the students in every seminar are international fellows, some of whom come from much different sort of civil military backgrounds, which is a whole interesting podcast in and of itself. But, well, Jackie, thank you so much for joining us. And I know I've been delighted to have you here and just more generally as a colleague. And so thank you. Thank you so much for speaking to us.
Yeah, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And Lawyers, Guns, and Money listeners, thank you for listening, and we will talk to you again soon.
Thank you again for listening to the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast. We would like to thank Elizabeth Nelson of The Paranoid Style for supplying the music necessary to make this podcast possible. You can find this track and the rest of The Paranoid Style's catalog anywhere you can find good music. If you would like to support the Lawyers, Guns, and Money podcast or any other aspect of the Lawyers, Guns, and Money project, please visit us at www.patreon.com/lawyersgunsandmoney or donate through a PayPal link on the main website. Thank you again.